Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola Cairncross. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. You may hear in the background that Wilfred Owen's got some friends to play, but we'll try and ignore them as much as possible. Today I'm also joined by Stephanie, Teresa, Linda and Heather.
Hello!
Hi.
This week on Right Club, Teresa will be reading to us from a work in progress, after which we will offer her our comments, just as we do in our Right Club meetings. We'll be talking about our writing lives before celebrating April Fool's Day, and we're going to hear what Steph and Eve White are reading at the moment. But first, Heather is going to ask us to
name the novel.
The protagonist in this book is a chivalrous Englishman living in France.
Ooh.
Mm. Well, I guess there aren't many of those, so we could...
They were generally cads if they had to go and live in France.
This book was a debut novel by this title author in 1905. It was written after the stage play of the same title enjoyed a long run in London, having opened in Nottingham in 1903. And the last clue, Zorro, The Shadow, Superman and Batman followed within a few decades, and the recurrent theme, a popular one in serial fiction today.
Oh, maybe it's not what I thought it was.
Oh, I'm thinking The Count of Monte Cristo.
Don't look at me.
Well, I thought, before you gave us clue three, I thought it might be The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness Orsi, but now I don't think it is.
It is The Scarlet Pimpernel by Baroness
Orsi. Fantastic.
What put you off about the third clue then?
Well, all that Superman and Batman and Spider-Man.
Well, it's
inspirational, isn't it?
Well, yeah, wasn't The Scarlet Pimpernel a bit Robin Hoodish?
Well, it's Secret Identity.
Ah,
the whole thing about the Scarlet Pimpernel was that nobody knew who, or a very few people knew who he was.
Right.
And his wife didn't even know who he was until his wife was called upon to start to try and find out who it was. But Batman, Superman all had secret identities.
Right. So she found it strange.
Yeah. I've never read it, but it's about rescuing aristocrats from the guillotine, isn't it?
During the French Revolution.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm sure there's a Carry On film where he features, but that's where my knowledge of the Scarlet Pimpernel.
It was actually a crossword clue in the Saturday Telegraph, and it just, I thought,
that was a good one. That was a really good one.
Thank you, Heather. That's fantastic. So, right, as I promised, we're going to hear Teresa read from her current work in progress. So what's Ronella up to now?
Well, Ronella is in big trouble.
Uh-oh.
So she's... there's been the event of chasing the mammoths out of the Morea, the region that they're living in, and somebody got hurt, and she's at fault because she could have warned the villagers that the longheads were driving the mammoths out. And also she's in trouble because she's revealed that she's friends with Kez. Ronella was cleaning the house. She had had the worst telling off of her life the night before. Grandpa Leo said it was her fault Ari had been hurt. She'd betrayed his trust again and again. She had left Larkin unprotected. She knew it would be no use to argue, better to stand and take it until he wore himself out. Then Aunt Marta had come to report that Ari seemed to be all right. There were no signs of fever or infection, and he should make a full recovery. Then she too gave Ronella a serious talking to about responsibility, protecting others and staying away from longheads. Later that night in the bedroom, Larkin had tried to comfort her, but was not in the mood to be comforted. She knew it wasn't fair to be angry at Larkin, but she couldn't help herself. She didn't ask to be the oldest, and she wasn't Larkin's mum. She cried herself to sleep, wishing her mum and dad would come back, refusing to believe they were gone forever. As she wiped the windows with vinegar, she could see Larkin in the alley, playing with a rope. She'd offered to help Ronella, but Ronella had told her to go away. Larkin was skipping slowly, without even bothering to sing the skipping rhyme. Ronella put down the rag she was cleaning with and went outside. She hugged Larkin to her and told her she was sorry. "Ow," Larkin said, "you're hurting me." Ronella let go and the two girls smiled sadly at each other. "Ari's in the square sitting in the shade," Larkin said. They walked around the corner and there he was on the coffee shop terrace, a glass of lemonade on the table and his bandaged leg resting on a stool. First man Orion's fur cloak lay on a seat beside him. Hi, girls, he greeted them with a smile. Ronella approached with her head down, her hands clasped in front of her. I'm sorry you got hurt, she said. It's not your fault, is it, my lovely? I should have warned Aunt Marta about the longhead plan. Accidents happen, Harry said cheerfully. I'd been wondering how I could spend more time with that lovely healer. That mammoth did me a favour. He winked at Ronella. Do you girls want a glass of lemonade? Ronella saw Marta standing in the doorway of the coffee shop. No thanks, I'm cleaning the house. Larkin can stay if she wants. No thanks, I'm going to help Ronella. As they turned to go home, a loud trumpet sounded from behind the school. What's that? Larkin asked. The longheads, Marta said. She looked at the girls. I don't suppose there's any point in sending you home, is there? Just stay out of sight, will you? Marta headed towards the basketball court. Harry took the folded cloak in one hand and a crutch in the other. You can give me a hand if you want, he said. Ronella smiled and took the cloak from him. Larkin took his free hand and the three of them set off slowly in the wake of people heading to the back of the school.
Well, we all want to know what's going on there, don't we? But I'm wondering how you skip slowly.
I know how you skip slowly, yes.
Now the thought occurred to me too, because if you go too slowly, the rope will just kind of collapse on you, you know?
Yeah. Over your head, onto the floor.
Yeah.
I thought that was a brilliant line. I thought that was a brilliant line, skipping slowly without even bothering to sing the skipping rhyme. I could just see her flopping
the rope. Desultory is the word,
yeah. Well, that is exactly the word, but I didn't want to use the word.
I thought that was lovely.
I loved it. It really set the emotion solidly, you know, what they're feeling. Desultory.
Yeah. I highlighted that as
a good bit of showing.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, and I remarked on how sad I felt when we got to the part where Ronella's crying herself to sleep and wanting her mum and dad and feeling like I didn't ask for all this responsibility.
Yeah, I like that bit, but I made a note. I think you can milk that some more.
Right.
I think you can really, you can maybe even, if you labour that point a little bit more, I think you might even get your readers to cry a little bit.
I'm not sure I want to go that far, but I'll think about it, yeah.
Because I think, you know, if you took us on that journey with her, you know, she wasn't the oldest and she wasn't Larkin's mum and mum's not here, and that's the whole point. Mum's not here and dad's not here either, and, you know. You see what I'm saying? I do think that if you want to, you know, really take people deeper into it, you could actually stress that.
Have we been told, because I agree, I think that, you know, especially in view of the fact as I was reading it, I was thinking, I can't remember what happened to them.
We don't know.
Okay, yeah. So they just disappeared one day.
Well, the truth, I haven't decided. I have different ideas about where they are and why they're absent.
A bit more than,
But,
because I think a child who'd lost their parents quite suddenly like that would dwell on it a bit more.
And then I thought the transition into the next paragraph, as she wiped the windows with vinegar, I thought actually you could use the emotion, because, you know, she sniffed, remembering last night, the tang of the vinegar made her sniff or something like that. That was another suggestion. So I think the transition between refusing to believe their parents are gone forever and wiping the window with vinegar was a bit abrupt.
I felt it too. It didn't feel right to me. I know I've said she was cleaning the house at the top, but then, you know, I've gone into this flashback.
But the vinegar was good because it, you know, it shows you that they haven't got any, you know, all of the chemicals and sprays that we've got now. They're having to revert to olden ways of cleaning.
Well, I know people that clean the windows with vinegar today.
Vinegar and newspaper.
Well, yes, my comment here was an exclamation. That's what we used in the one-room schoolhouse.
Well,
an old crumpled newspaper.
Well, they don't have newspapers. There isn't a printing press, I've decided. Lots of people are using homemade cleaning products these days.
They are. No, I think it's really shaping up beautifully, becoming a bit of a page turner.
Thank you.
It really is. Well, I thought it was a bit of a page turner before. I've been, you know, sitting on the edge of my seat with some of the earlier passages when the woman took Larkin away, and oh, that's dreadful, and and also when, you know, the dog went missing with, or she thought he was missing and Larkin missing in the beginning. I wasn't that attached to the characters yet, but I felt something's really going to come from that. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying, you know, I love the story and I'm really interested in what happens next. I'd like to read what you've done.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions. They're not criticisms at all. They're just things that I'm not sure if I've understood or missed significance on. First, when Orion's fur coat sat on a seat beside him.
Yes, I forgot to mention in my preamble.
Yeah.
So Ari needed a stretcher.
Oh.
And I should have said the first man, Orion, I keep changing their name, so I confuse myself sometimes, is Kes's grandfather and the leader of the Longheads. Yeah. So when it's a scene that you haven't seen where they meet after the mammoth stampede and Ari is injured and the healer, who is a young one called Ketty at the moment, asks for them to make a makeshift stretcher and he gives them the cloak and they get some branches and make a stretcher.
I very innocently just thought, oh, she'll explain that some other time.
I meant to mention it in my preamble and I
especially as they're now taking it off to the basketball club. I thought there's some significance in this cape and I've missed it.
I thought there's a scene or two before this that we haven't seen yet.
Definitely.
Well, that's always the one.
And I think maybe the scene that you were talking about when Larkin is taken hasn't been on the podcast, so maybe next time I might bring that when
I'm
it's my
so
turn. It's perfectly fine from my point of view, but we did it in our off-air But I'll do it on the podcast some other time.
So, Linda, are you ready to entertain, enlighten, or amuse us?
kind of. Yeah, I have an amuse-bouche here. I ask all of you before this to count your sundokus. If you haven't heard much about it so far, the books that you have accumulated, bought, and haven't yet read. You intend to someday, but
yeah, Steph introduced it, didn't she?
Yeah,
right at the beginning of the podcast.
Right.
It's a sundoku.
But I wanted to say first something I thought was great about accumulating books. A. Edward Newton, and I don't really know who he was, but it says a magnificent farce and other diversions of a book collector. I guess was the book that it came from. And he said, even when reading is impossible, the presence of books acquired produces such an ecstasy that the buying of more books than one can read is nothing less than the soul reaching toward infinity. We cherish books even if unread. Their mere presence exudes comfort. Their ready access reassurance. Isn't that wonderful?
I agree with it too.
Here's the opposite from Faye Weldon. She says, I am not fond of books as objects. I like the contents, but trapped in their bindings, they seem almost threatening in any number. In bookshops, I long to escape. Don't get me wrong, I love books. I love talking about books. I teach creative writing at a university. I make my students read Tennyson's The Lotus Eaters aloud, if only to admire the internal rhythms and notice the power of what happens in the reader's head. When the writer changes from ductile to spondee, I just don't want to own books.
How weird is that?
Yeah, that's very strange.
I don't know. Faye Weldon, you need to let us know how that works. I can't imagine where that came from. I mean, the desire not to own books.
For a lot of people, I think it's about space, isn't it?
Yeah, but she's not saying that.
No, she's saying
she finds something threatening about
it. I understand if you're living in a camper van and travelling around that you'd rather have e-books, obviously,
The only thing I miss, having got rid of all of my possessions, and in fact the last but one thing to go was a suitcase full of my very best books. And I had a cupboards full up until that point.
Yeah.
It's the only thing I really miss. Yeah. And even now I can't buy a decent book. I have to buy it on Kindle. And I think that's not such a rich experience for me.
I don't think it is. I had them in my previous house. I had a large family room and I had floor to ceiling books all around three walls. The other wall was windows and fireplace, but three walls, floor to ceiling. I hadn't read them all. I love them. Mm-hmm. I just love being there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sitting in a chair. Surrounded.
Your Sundoku room.
That's what it was. And then there's this bit from Goodreads. It's Alberto Manuel, The Library at Night. I have no feelings of guilt regarding the books I have not read and perhaps will never read. I know that my books have unlimited patience. They will wait for me till the end of my days. And when reading some of these comments that people make about their tsundokos, I was impressed with the way they imbue them with human traits and
personalities.
Very close to the books, having a relationship with them. So I went to a site called Atlas Obscura, and Eric Grindhauser has written this article and compiled a lot of people talking about their collections. He says, how big is your unread collection? And this gentleman from Brussels says, if you mean my to-read pile, hundreds. He says, new purchases go on the shelf, but the to-read pile evolves depending on a variety of factors, including, is it a movie or TV version coming out soon? Is it related to my upcoming travels? I like to alternate fiction and nonfiction, fun and serious. Apart from that, it's an organic, flexible process. So, and another man from New York says he has upwards of 300 between his apartment and his parents' attic.
Yeah, it doesn't sound excessive.
about right.
I've read, though.
He says, I love them, fear them, occasionally leave them a small sacrifice to ensure their favour in the coming year.
I love it.
That means another one, doesn't it?
And Elizabeth from Massachusetts says, 130, and that's just the ones at school. I have at least that many on a bookcase at home. She says, it's an aesthetic addition to my room. I find that organizing the books in a mosaic of stacks as a centerpiece creates the opportunity for a more animated dialogue between myself and my books. She talks to her books rather than show. During the day, I will glance at them and rediscover a title I had forgotten I had. So the marvelous feeling of a potential adventure is always at my fingertips. Isn't that wonderful?
Great.
And here's one who sounds like maybe a little obsessive compulsive literature. Her stack is 101. They have their own shelves. They cannot be touching the other books that I have finished. The one shelf shares space with some notebooks, and they are allowed to touch those. Some of the people have arranged theirs by color. Some have stacked them according to theme. And mine are sort of scattered around. Mm-hmm. There are some shelves, and then I have a lot on Kindle. And when I was looking at them and trying to figure out how many I had this week, I tried to put them all together, but was no use. Hal's books are way in the way. Put it out. I have 97.
Wow.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I had a bunch on my Kindle. I think I had like 52 on my Kindle, and then the rest were on shelves.
Right.
Isn't that awesome?
And how long have you lived in that house?
We've lived in that house for, 3 years now?
Yeah. That's pretty impressive. Well, she's gathered them in 3 years.
At the rate of 33 a year.
Very good.
That's without the ones she's thrown away.
And I did not count reference books because I figured those are not things that I read all the way through, you know.
Right. What about you, Heather?
Well, I counted up 16 since Christmas. This is the person who said that I didn't want any new books for 2019 because goodness knows how many I've got. Some of it I've read but I've kept because I want to read them again at some point, and those that I haven't read. But yes, yeah, since Christmas, I've got 6 actual books on a little shelf and 10 books on my Kindle.
Just since Christmas. And this is April the 1st.
Yes. So 4 of them. I went to see the play Noughts and Crosses by Mallory Blackman a few weeks ago. So I've just downloaded 4 of her books.
Great stuff.
I've got them spread because we've got 2 houses. Mm-hmm. I've got them spread in rooms. I've got them in boxes in the loft.
Oh my God.
So to actually count them would be, I think, almost impossible. Mm, wow. But I was quite impressed that I bought that many since Christmas. Yes. Or borrowed. Yes. A couple of them I have borrowed.
Yes. But that's not your entire Tsundoku.
That's just what's to hand.
Yes.
Since Christmas.
So if I had to press you for a figure, an estimate of the entire collection, the unread books?
Well, I don't know about unread. There's probably maybe 100 unread.
Okay.
But there's more that I've kept. I've got the complete series of Terry Pratchett, and I've got Dickens and Agatha Christie, you know, sort of complete works. But I've kept all those because...
I keep everything.
That's not your Sundoku, that's just the books.
I just have thousands of books.
Okay, Teresa, how big's your Sundoku?
Well, when Linda asked this question, I happened to be in my holiday home. So this is just in my holiday home. And I counted 50 actual books, and I spotted one or two the next day, actually, that I hadn't included. I don't dare go to my Kindle because when I see a 99p bargain by a writer I like or a freebie, you know, and at home, my house is a Victorian boarding house at the seaside, and there are 9 bedrooms and every room has bookshelves and books in it. So I don't, and some of them are unread, but I've got included in the ones I saw in my holiday home, Chocolat, A God in Ruins. See, these are things people say, you must read this and give it to you. I've got books by Thomas Pynchon because I thought, well, I've never read any Thomas Pynchon. I must get that. I've got books by Joyce Carol Oates that I've not opened.
I've got one of hers.
Me too.
Yeah. Blonde, it's called. So, I've had it for about 4 years.
Rather a lot of books. And I think I perhaps do have a problem.
If I had to press you for a number on the Sudoku?
I think you could probably, if you include my Kindle and everything, you could probably triple or quadruple that, I would guess.
So 150 maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Ah.
But I'm going to read them.
Of course you are. Steph?
Well, I went round the house taking photographs off my bookshelf so that I didn't have to actually get them all out, and I was really shocked.
Oh.
By how many books? I had 32 physical books that I haven't read, and that's fiction books, just on the shelves around the house. That doesn't count the loft full and the stuff that's in storage and all that stuff. That's just bookshelves in the sitting room, the bedroom, and as I say, it doesn't count any reference books. So I've got at least 20 books about writing.
Yes, me too.
I didn't count. And some of those I've read, some of those I've dipped in and out, some of them I've never even opened.
Yeah.
I have to say thank you, Linda, because I went through my Kindle to have a look at my Kindle, and I had a good old clear out of all the stuff I've read.
Oh.
And actually, I had loads of samples. I must have had 50 samples.
Mm. Well, I think there's no point in having a sample. You either buy the book or you don't.
No, I don't agree. Well, the sample can tell you whether you want to buy the book, and they're useful for a bit of research or, you know.
Exactly, So I went through all the samples, and I decided that I would keep probably... less than half of them, because I thought, do I really want to read this book? So one of my samples was Fahrenheit 451, which I really want to read because I've never read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 15 fiction books on my Kindle, along with the 32 physical fiction books, that's 47. And that's, as I say, just on the bookshelves around the house. It doesn't count stuff that I've got elsewhere. And it doesn't count my Audible or...
Yeah.
My boxes that are under the bed kind of thing. I mean, I didn't even bother opening those because the dust is too much. Well, I wouldn't like to estimate.
Well, I've got to say, I didn't have any such thing as a Sundoku. I bought a book and I read it until I met you lot. And then, because you started talking about it and I started to feel a bit left out, I have started to accumulate books that I haven't read, and I've there's a feeling of delicious decadence about it. There really is.
Yeah.
And especially when you get them for 99p, although that probably wouldn't, the writers listening probably wouldn't like that. 17 since Christmas.
And they're all Kindle
because I don't dare get proper physical books.
Yeah.
Because I can't bear to part with them. I can't bear to leave them behind.
Right, yeah.
And 4 business books that I'm not reading at all at the moment. So they're piling up horribly because I'm listening to that blooming podcast.
Well,
I've got no time to read, except I did read one last night.
Oh.
An entire one.
Well, one of the things I find is that after they've been there for a certain length of time, because, you know, you go looking over them sometimes, and I think, after a while, it's like, oh, that old thing. I don't
So it feels like you've read it already.
No, it just feels like I'm not in the mood to read that one anymore.
Yeah, it's hard to choose.
Well, they do say that, you know, when you're addicted, you know when you're addicted, if, you know, for instance, if you're addicted to cigarettes or alcohol, it's not, have you got a packet of cigarettes? It's where's the next packet coming from? Have you got a bottle of wine? Right. Where's the next bottle of wine coming from? And I'm definitely addicted to books because if I go away, I have to, you know, I have to take far more books than I could ever physically read in the period that I'm away, because I need to know that when I finish this book, there's another one lined up, which is where the Kindle is a wonderful piece of kit.
I thought you were going to say I have to take far more books than I take clean pairs of pants.
Well, yes. Yeah. No, I mean, seriously, that would probably be it.
Yeah.
It's very bad. It's very bad.
It is.
So thank you very much, Linda. That's a longer amuse-bouche than because we all got passionate about our Sundokos. So if you're addicted to books, as Stephanie calls it, and feeling a little bit deliciously decadent about your Sundoku, or are you feeling a little bit stressed about it, we'd love to hear about it. Come and tell us in the Facebook group. That would be great. Right, so let's go round the room, the bit you've all been looking forward to, and find out who's doing what in our writing lives. Shall we go anti-clockwise this time, I think?
I'm not writing very much at all.
Okay.
I'm writing submissions. I'm targeting myself at one a week. And they're getting easier because as I've done so many, I've normally now got 3 chapters or 10,000 words.
It's
getting easier as I do more because I've got the basic blueprint there. And I'm trying to catch up, actually, on my Sundoku. So I'm trying to read. Uh-huh. I thought, I'm going to have a month off of writing and I'm just going to read. And that's what I'm doing.
Well,
I am reading my own work as well as, as well as books, because I think that helps. But, yeah, so I'm not writing a huge amount.
And are you thinking about your next project?
I'm thinking a lot.
That's good.
I'm thinking a lot. That's really why I'm reading.
You need that time.
Yeah. Marinating. What about you, Teresa?
Well, I've been working on plotting a lot, and that's helped me to be more productive on the writing side as well. And I have in the past started novels and got to 5, 6, maybe 8,000 words and run out of steam. And I think that's because of not having plotted properly. Mm. So that's helped me a lot. So I'm really excited at having reached 10,000 words with Ronella. So that's really exciting.
As a new writer, can you just explain to me what plotting means, just in case I'm not understanding it properly?
Well, just planning ahead and knowing where the story's going. And so at the moment, I'll write maybe 500, 1,000 words, and I know what the next scene is that I have to write, but I'll think about it overnight because I know what it has to be. And then in the morning, I can write it.
And have you got some sort of outline?
I've done a spreadsheet. Overall, some people use cards. Some people use diagrams. It's whatever works for you. I like a spreadsheet because I can insert a line if I find what I thought was a chapter turns into 2, and I can delete rows if I need to. So that works for me. But it's just about working out where the story's going, what's going to happen, in the future now. After, so for example, the bit I read today, the next thing is they go to this meeting with the Longheads where they discuss certain things. And then, life goes back to normal for a little while and then something really bad happens. So, I know where I'm going with the story. So that helps me to be more productive as a writer. So I would say I'm feeling very positive, but I don't want to come across as smug, because I will say I've been doing this for 10 years, trying to be a writer. And I feel like I'm learning a lot, I'm progressing, and I'm hopefully going to actually complete a novel one day.
Well, I have every confidence. Every confidence.
Heather? Well, I am feeling quite smug because I've written a play. I'm actually waiting to find out whether our local amateur dramatic group are going to perform.
Oh, that's your first one.
It's a comedy. But I won't share just yet what it's all about. Wait and see what they say. But it, again, as Therese has just said, it's taught me an awful lot about plotting. When I started trying to just write the dialogue, I realised I was getting wound up and lost. So I used post-it notes and just used it and planned, so I'm waving my hands about, planned what I was going to say and what each individual character was and that sort of thing. And it did teach me quite a bit. But
did you use different coloured post-it notes for each character?
Yes. Oh, no, I didn't use for each character, but for the, because some of it's about gossip and rumour, so I used different colours for the various themes.
That's interesting. You know me, I love to know how things are done.
Yes. But even if they don't want it, I've had a couple of comments for people that are ready who said they thought it was very funny, which is the aim. So.
Well, that's very good. Lovely. Excellent. What about you, Linda?
Well, I've been making more progress than usual, and that's because I think I've found my muse. And it's the Sandman.
It's the Sandman.
The Sandman. When I go to sleep, I...
Oh, well, there you go. You don't get enough sleep.
Well, you know, what happens is this week especially, and I think I told you about one time in the past when I went to sleep with a problem in the plot on my mind, and I woke up, and there it was in my head. And this week, I was trying to write something and I didn't know what was going to happen next and it was worrying me. So I thought, I'm going to really put this out there tonight for my subconscious. And so I thought about it so much before I went to sleep. I don't know what's going to happen. I need to know what's going to happen. Where do I go from here? And I woke up in the morning and it was in my head. Wow. And I just sat down and wrote it all down. I'm not kidding you.
No, I'm not exaggerating. This is, you know, also going for a walk, going for a swim, doing some yoga. All of those things can really liberate your mind.
But sleeping, I like that one.
Yes, my favourite thing in the world.
For the listeners, Linda's not known as our deepest sleeper, are you? You spend quite a bit of time up in the middle of the night.
I'm an insomniac,
Oh, well, that's great news. That's
brilliant. Yeah.
So you're just going to try and have an early night every week or something?
I thought maybe in the middle of the day, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I think if I just try to go to bed at a decent time and keep it in mind that subconscious is going to take over.
Yeah.
I've praised it so much it has to.
Absolutely. I know lots of people who do that. They set a problem before they go to sleep.
What are you up to now then?
Well, not writing very much as I'd like. I've been a really busy patch with work and trying to catch up because I've had a new virtual assistant and I've had to induct her in, as it were. But no, she's coming up to speed really quickly. And I've today, literally as I walked in here today, I've had three frantic days and I'm actually a week ahead of myself on everything. And I it's a great feeling, I've got to say. But I can't write unless I don't have any work stuff to do.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is divide my days into work time up until 2 o'clock and writing after 2 o'clock. And I've put in an actual appointment with myself every afternoon from 2 o'clock. So what I'm finding is every time I cancel one of those, and I'm making myself, I'm not letting myself just let it slide, I'm actually cancelling it out. I'm aware that I'm letting myself down and my writing down.
Oh, goody. Well, that gets a lot done.
Well, no, but it's
psychology. It's understanding yourself and what works for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm looking forward to going to Australia for a month soon, so I'm looking forward to lots of freer time because I will be on my own quite a lot and I won't have any fun things to do like hang out with you guys. So.
Nicola has a speaking engagement.
Three. I've got three now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's going to be good fun. But I will have a lot of spare time in a strange city, so I'm going to use the time to write.
Excellent.
Good. But I've been doing lots of plotting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've done some writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
When I do it, it comes easy, so it's...
That's good. It's the preparation, isn't it?
Yes. Mm. The marinating. Okay, so now it is time to celebrate April Fool's Day. We had a few discussions about whether we should play any tricks on our listeners, but we decided against that in the end, didn't we?
No, because we love you too much. Yeah, we don't want to be tricking you.
And we couldn't think of anything good.
Yeah. You did try, though, didn't you? So what have you come up with, ladies? Who's going to start off?
Well, I have a rather distressing announcement, I think, that I read, and it's about Amazon. You know what a behemoth they are, and they're always acquiring everything. And now I read that they've acquired the English language, and they're going to privatize it. If you want to use it, then you're going to have to
pay a licensing fee.
Yeah, to the sheep.
That's good.
So let's hear from Pat, because she recorded some April Fool's pranks for us of a literary persuasion.
You may have seen recently a film called Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's recently been released. Well, the film was based on memoir of Lee Israel. Well, she was possibly more well-known in America than in the UK. But she was a journalist who during the 60s and 70s made quite a decent living. And then she started producing biographies. And her first couple were really successful, made the bestseller lists and so on. But her third biography in 1985 was absolutely panned by the critics. It was about Estee Lauder. And another reason for it not doing very well was the fact that Lauder actually released her own memoir at the time. So that left her sort of a bit high and dry, and she ended up on welfare. And she was in desperate need of money, not only to pay her own living costs, but her cat was really poorly, and she was besotted by this cat and desperately needed money to pay for the cat's vet's bills. So in 1991, Israel entered the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, and she stole three letters, which she then managed to sell on for reasonable amounts of cash to keep her going. So for the next 2 years, this is kind of how she made a living. She realised that there was a market for this sort of thing. So she started inventing letters from various people. She bought a couple of old typewriters, and she took old paper from the backs of library books and produced fake letters from people like Noel Coward and Fanny Bryce and her favourite, Dorothy Parker. She sold them for cash, made a living at it. But then after a while, people started to question where these were coming from. So she decided maybe this wasn't such a good idea. So then she went back to stealing originals from the libraries, and she would substitute her fakes the library ones, so that quick glance they'd think, oh, no problem there. But the game was up in 1993. She was actually found out, the FBI were alerted and investigated, and she stood trial. She was sentenced to 6 months house arrest and 5 years of probation. She got away. She was facing the prison sentence at one point, but wow, in the end she got away with it. But then once that was finished, she actually wrote the memoir and explained all about it and made loads of money from the memoir, and then, of course, the film as well. One of the most famous fakes, I suppose, was the Hitler Diaries. Well, it was in early 1983. German newspaper Stern had announced the discovery of 60 small notebooks purported to be the personal diary of Adolf Hitler. And these had been brought to them by a journalist, Gert Heidemann, and the newspaper paid him a small fortune for these items, which he said had been recovered from an airplane crash shortly after the end of the Second World War and then smuggled to the West from communist East Germany. And this, I can remember the furore about it and the discovery. And Hugh Trevor Roper, is it a historian, British historian, probably for the Telegraph, he looked at them and said, yes, these were authentic, these were the right things. And lots of experts said, validated them, but they'd only had a brief look. The newspaper had restricted access to the diaries, and they'd allowed various experts to look at them, but only briefly. In May of that year, the archives looked into the matter at the request of the West German government, and they declared them to be fake. and very bad fakes at that. The handwriting didn't match. They'd been created using modern materials. And nobody knows what happened to the millions of Deutschmarks paid for the documents. But both Heidemann, the journalist, and his accomplice, who was a forger, Konrad Kujau, went to jail. It was a huge story at the time. An English example, but this time dating back to the 18th century, involves a William Henry Ireland, who was the young son of a British engraver and Shakespeare aficionado called Samuel Ireland. And William Henry presented his father with a new startling new discovery, a mortgage deed supposedly signed by William Shakespeare himself. The elder Ireland was obviously thrilled, and William claimed he'd discovered the document in a friend's collection and hinted that there was more to come. And soon, sure enough, there were receipts and contracts, correspondence between Shakespeare and a patron, a letter from Queen Elizabeth, a love poem William wrote to his wife Anne Hathaway, and, amazingly, two previously undiscovered plays, Henry II and Vortigern and Rowena. Well, the islands came London celebrities, but eagle-eyed experts soon pointed out a number of inaccuracies. The writing on the documents didn't match, you know, the few examples they had of Shakespeare's handwriting. And in 1796, the most respected scholar of the time published his own scathing critique, said no way are these genuine. And then I think the final blow was a disastrous performance of Vortigern. When it was actually produced, people just thought, absolutely no way to do with William Shakespeare. Yeah, William Ireland confessed to the whole thing, claiming he'd created the documents in an effort to please his cold, distant father. Whereas, you know, the other two have done it for money. I thought that was really sad. I think this last one, though, is potentially my favourite. Thomas Chatterton, and I had never heard of him prior to doing the research for this particular item. He was born in 1752, somewhere near Bristol, and his father, a choir master at church, had died 3 months before Thomas was born. So he was brought up by a devoted mother. At first, he was considered quite slow in learning, and he made very slow progress with his alphabet. But one day, he saw his mother tear up as waste paper one of his father's old French musical folios. And the boy was entranced by its illuminated capital letters. And that actually sort of engaged him. And he learned to read from these documents. And he actually learned to read far in advance of his age. And he had these music folios, a black letter Bible, and items taken by his father from a chest in the Church of St. Mary Redcliffe. And it was here, still at a very young age, I think 10 or 11, he claimed to have discovered poems written by a 15th century monk named Thomas Rowley, a fictitious character actually created by Chatterton. So he used some of these old papers, he copied the writing style that he'd seen, but he actually created poems that were hailed as a magnificent find. Experts were unstinting in their praise of the work. And this was at the age of 11, 12. He was supposed to go into the law, so he was apprenticed, but used to spend all his time producing poems. Finally managed to get himself released from his apprenticeship. And at 17, he set out for London to storm the city with satires and pamphlets. He produced a lively comic opera, The Revenge, which brought him in some money. But then the death of a prospective patron quenched Chatterton's hopes. And literally starving, Chatterton refused the food offered by friends. And on the night of August the 24th, 1770, at the age of 17, he took arsenic in his Holborn garret and died. And after that, literary greats Keats and Coleridge later wrote poems about this romantic and rebellious youth. And Wordsworth dubbed him the marvellous boy. There's even a painting of him by Henry Wallace hanging in the Tate's London Gallery. So he never lived to see the edition of his poems that was published or see the monument his well-wishers had placed outside St. Mary Redcliffe. However, that statue was removed during church renovations and never replaced because officials felt it was blasphemous to keep a monument to a suicidal boy on holy ground. And when last seen, the statue lay forgotten in a council storage shed.
Poor old Chatterton, and he's very highly thought of these days.
He is. In fact, I found a prank that seems that it was inspired by Chatterton. There was a young Bangladeshi man of 16 years old who some years ago wrote a series of poems in the style of a Bengali poet from the 15th century. And then said that he discovered them when he was in the library doing some research. And they were taken really, really seriously by the Indian Bangladeshi literary community. And in fact, there was a PhD student in a German university that used those poems for his thesis and actually won his doctorate by referencing these so-called poems by Boussingar or something. It was such a successful ruse. So it sounds like he was a little bit inspired by Chatterton got up to. Yeah. That's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah,
brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
It makes you wonder, though, doesn't it, why people who are so creative and clever waste their creativity and cleverness on trying to hoodwink everybody rather than trying to create something authentic.
I think it's a lot of fun.
If you wrote a medieval poem or a poem in the medieval style, people wouldn't be very interested. It would just be considered a bit odd. But if you say, I found it in a mouldy old chest written on vellum, then it becomes something else.
Mm. Yeah. So do you think it's a desire to create in the style of and... So do you think the creativity comes first and the hoodwinkery comes afterwards?
I don't know. I am merely speculating. Yeah. But, you know, I think conning, again, it's one of those things that people can get pleasure from actually fooling people.
Like the Hitler's Diary thing at the Times. Yeah. We all remember that.
Yeah, the biography of Howard Hughes, that was supposedly official biography of Howard Hughes, which was a work of fiction.
Well, I read quite a few of the ones you've mentioned, but I also realised just how gullible I am because I realised everything I read, I was reading about all these people that I would definitely have believed in.
Oh, I would have done too.
And then I started to think about all the silly things like the spaghetti tree and the square eggs and walking backwards being a
spaghetti harvest.
My dad had us all going about haggis, that they were little round creatures that ran around mountains and one leg was shorter than the other.
Two legs on. I think Spike Milligan originated
my daughter believed that until she was quite well into her teens and she was mortified when she realised that she'd been so silly to have thought it was real. But I just thought that I would have fallen for all of the things that I read about.
Well, I fell for one. Speaking of, the fake autobiography is a classic and there is some debate about, whether it matters who wrote it or whether. But this book, I did not know that it was a fake autobiography. I thought it was real until I reached a point in it where I suddenly thought, no, I don't believe this story anymore.
What's the book?
I will tell you. Uh-huh. It's called Sister of the Road, The Autobiography of Boxcar Bertha, as told to Dr. Ben Reitman, supposedly. And it was published in 1937 and purported to be the frank, uncensored story of a wandering woman of the underworld. Intimate facts of a woman hobo's methods and habits, a life story that has no parallel. And it's very good. I was really interested in it, but there's a point when she gets involved in prostitution. It's not that I don't believe, but there's some of the details, and I suddenly went, no, that's not true. And at the end of this particular edition, which is from AK Press, there is a postscript which tells you that many people did believe it was a genuine autobiography. But it's a good read anyway, but I absolutely had no idea when I bought it that it was fake.
Oh, I'd love to borrow that. Fantastic.
After you.
Yes, there's a queue for Boxcar Bertha.
That is Sundoku.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, God, I've got a real one now. She's infiltrated my possessionless living. Oh, that's awesome. So thank you very much, everyone. That's really funny. It's almost time to end, but before we go, there's just time for Steph and Eve White to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Stephanie, what's on your bedside table?
Right, I am reading The Chestnut Man by Søren Sveistrup.
It's in my list.
It's not the sort of thing I would normally read, but I'm a member of a couple of book clubs, and this one was chosen by one of the book clubs. It's billed as a gripping debut novel from the creator of the TV show The Killing.
Oh!
So I was quite fascinated when I saw that.
That sounds good.
It opens with a murder, as they always do.
Yeah.
But the person that's been murdered has one of her hands amputated. Her hand is missing. And near her body is a doll made of chestnuts, a chestnut doll or a chestnut man. And on it is the thumbprint of a young girl who's been missing for a year, who a man has confessed to her murder and been imprisoned.
But they never found the body?
They never found the body, and she was the daughter of a politician. So that's as far as I've got.
It sounds brilliant already.
Well, it's not, as I say, it's pitched as being Joe Nesbo style, but I wouldn't know because that isn't my thing.
Mm.
It's also, they say it's Scandi Noir.
Yeah.
But I must say, even though it's not the kind of thing I would normally read, I now need to know happened. I am now, and there's another body, and the hands are missing again, and so on, and the body count is mounting. So I need to know how this girl, the chestnut, the little chestnut boy, and the women without hands are related. So I'm going to have to finish the damn thing now.
No doubt coming to BBC Four sometime.
Yes, yes. Scandi Noir, think Shetland with more snow and unpronounceable names.
Okay.
I love Scandi Noir, it's one of my favourites. And Eve White, what are you reading at the moment?
I've just recently finished Bitter by Francesca Jacobi, which was a book that was given to me in beautiful hardback by the publisher Weidenfeld Nicholson. And it's an absolutely brilliant read about a woman who's got huge and massive regrets in her life. And in the course of the novel, she makes terrible mistakes, and you're sort of agonized by watching her make these terrible mistakes. But eventually and finally, she begins to come out of it, and it's just absolutely a wonderful character study, and I loved it.
Thanks very much, Eve. Well, thank you all for joining us once again. If you'd like to show your appreciation for the podcast, one of the top ways is to subscribe in iTunes or Stitcher, so every new show is automatically delivered. Join our Facebook group, come and talk to us, but most of all, leave a review. It's the most important thing you can do to help. Oh, and tell a friend about Write Club too. We'll be back next week at the same time for another episode of Write Club the podcast. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye.